So just 3 months ago, on April 2nd, Algeria's dictator, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, stepped down after 2 decades of rule. Less than 10 days later, Omar al-Bashir, head of Sudan's military dictatorship for 30 years, also stepped down. Both were forced out by mass protests that emerged this past winter, led by students, workers, and feminists in outrage at IMF austerity measures, cost and standard of living, high rates of unemployment, corruption and the patriarchal nature of the state, and the inability of ordinary people to have a voice in their political system. Their ouster marked the first major victories in the region since the start of what became known as the Arab Spring back in 2011, or more appropriately, the MENA, Middle East North Africa revolutions. Beginning in 2011, the region saw 2 years of the working classes engaging in popular democracy for the first time in decades, bringing about incredible victories, beginning with the toppling of Ben Ali and Mubarak, and challenging the regimes, their imperialist backers, and the capitalist order itself, before a counter-revolutionary turn took over the region and managed to dominate it for the past 6 years. Today's uprisings in Sudan and Algeria remind us that this process is not over, that these movements are a part of a long-term revolutionary process throughout the region that will remain unresolved until fundamental changes are made to a stifling political and economic reality. In fact, over the past few years, even under the backdrop of counter-revolution, we've seen waves of uprisings rooted in the progressive demands of the 2011 revolutions, re-emerging from Morocco to Jordan, Lebanon to Iraq, Iran and Tunisia and beyond, with no sign of resolution. But the uprisings in Sudan and Algeria today still stand out among these. They mark the first momentous victory since the start of the 2011 revolutions, and along with this, key lessons that their working classes have learned from the first wave of the Arab Spring that will allow them to go further this time around. As in 2011, when the revolutions were sparked by soaring unemployment levels, police brutality, and the weight of decades of neoliberal reforms, once again in Sudan and Algeria this winter, the root causes were economic stagnation combined with a stifling authoritarian political system that repressed any attempts at independent organizing. In Algeria, mass protests broke out in late February after Bouteflika announced running for a fifth term. This despite the fact that he had not been seen in public for years since a stroke left him unable to speak in 2013. He's what could be called an octogenarian president, meaning he's over 80 years old and was in fact hardly functional at all, but his presidency served to keep those around him comfortable in their positions of power. So Algerians called this a mafia regime, cognizant of the way that clans of businessmen and generals robbed the wealth of the country. This is as youth unemployment rose to 30% in a country where 70% of the population is under the age of 30. These numbers are similar to those across the region, and the high levels of unemployment have been a major driver of the uprisings in 2011, and they'll continue to bring the youth out into the streets in their masses. The protests that began in Algeria on February 22nd also expressed outrage at poverty wages and working conditions and crumbling public services, and they soon called for system dégage, for the entire system and all those responsible for it to fall. The chant, "the people want them all to go," echoes the same chant of 2011 heard around the world, "the people want the fall of the regime." In Sudan too, the protests sparked by a rise in bread prices quickly moved to the chant, "Tasqut bas," just fall. Protests began in December in the town of Atbara, a town with a deep labor and revolutionary history, over a threefold hike in the price of bread. But as this initial protest grew in Atbara, demonstrators burnt the local headquarters of the National Congress Party, Omar al-Bashir's party, to the ground. Protests spread from Atbara to towns across Sudan before finally reaching Khartoum, the capital. Though Sudan's protests received little attention in the US during their first few months, their demands represented an immediate challenge to not only al-Bashir's regime, but the counter-revolutionary order across the MENA region. In fact, the protests began at the very same time that Omar al-Bashir was visiting Syria's Bashar al-Assad as the first Arab League leader to essentially welcome him back into the fold after the Arab League had kicked him out soon after the start of the Arab Spring for his butchery. Sudanese protesters showing their revulsion for the counter-revolutionary order and the butchery of both dictators displayed giant Syrian revolutionary flags at their protests in solidarity with the Syrian people. So once again, the spark lit by day-to-day conditions was the tip of the volcano of decades of anger and misery, soon pulling out hundreds of thousands and then millions into the streets. In Algeria, a country of 42 million people, the weekly Friday protests bring out well over 10 million across the country, and some estimating up to 22 million on certain Fridays, which is over half the country's population. Algeria's uprising is organized mainly around these massive Friday protests, bringing together all sectors of the population, as well as student-led protests each Tuesday, and ongoing labor strikes, particularly of oil and gas workers who have the ability to cripple the economy. Each of these has been instrumental to forcing Bouteflika and a handful of his cronies to leave. So to get an idea of the revolutionary spirit of the protests, you have the fact that half the country's population is out in the streets, waving Algerian and Amazigh or Berber flags and Palestinian flags, likening the struggle to Algeria's anti-colonial war of liberation against the French, saying, we overthrew the French and we'll overthrow you too. You have feminist contingents and women raising feminist demands, and you have celebratory and creative signs and banners like, we woke up and you will pay, and the people want control alt delete, and a'udhu billah min ash-shaytan al-rajim, if people recognize that one. One center of creativity in the protest movement is a giant unfinished building in Borj Bou Arish called the People's Palace, where hundreds of people stand on every level of this giant building and thousands more around it, lighting sparklers and most visibly draping enormous creative cartoon-covered banners each Friday over the building's many stories. And they say things like, justice must be the basis of governance. The town has been named the capital of the Hayrak, the capital of the popular movement. It's very reminiscent of the creative banners drawn weekly in the town of Kafr Anbil, Syria, displaying humorous messages to the world throughout the course of the Syrian revolution. The millions of workers and students bursting onto the stage of history are determined to narrate their own destiny, reimagine the possibilities for their society, and they're doing it with creative genius and flair to boot. Meanwhile, in Sudan, the protests that began in Atbara and spread through Sudan's working class towns came to Khartoum, the capital. In January, a wide spectrum of opposition organizations, including leftist, communist, and more traditional Islamist opposition parties, came together under the Forces for Freedom and Change, putting forward an agenda for a transition to democratic civilian rule. Most important among them is the Sudanese Professionals Association, a coalition of 8 independent trade unions, including doctors, teachers, and lawyers, who had been organizing in secret for the past several years after being banned by the regime. By coordinating demands and tactics nationally, including multiple strikes that shut down the country's airports and emptied the streets, the SPA transformed the movement into a revolution. The major turning point was on April 6th, when the SPA called for the first million-person march and sit-in across from Khartoum's Army General Command. This moment, the mass coordinated march and takeover of the area outside the Army headquarters was what tipped the scales of the uprising. Demonstrators occupied the square, taking it as their own, reappropriating the space for the revolution. They split shifts so that demonstrators were there day and night for nearly 2 months straight, setting up civilian checkpoints to ensure no weapons could enter, filling the space with murals of the martyrs and revolutionary slogans, playing music and reciting poetry and holding political strategizing sessions. Other sit-ins also emerged in other cities across Sudan, also with revolutionary committees and health clinics and educational sessions on revolutionary struggles to take lessons from. It's no exaggeration whatsoever to compare the Khartoum sit-in to Cairo's Tahrir Square and Khartoum's revolutionary committees and neighborhood committees, that spread out from the headquarters into the city to the thousands of planning committees and coordinating committees from the early days of the Arab Spring. And just a week after the SBA called for this occupation of the army headquarters, Omar al-Bashir was forced to leave office. 30 hours after that, his successor, Ibn Auf, was also forced to bow out. One of the iconic scenes from Khartoum after the fall of al-Bashir is of protesters from the town of Atbara, which is where the revolution started, on the train arriving to celebrate the dictator's fall, greeting thousands of revolutionaries. Many of you may have seen this image. The image led the Financial Times, I didn't believe it either, to publish a piece stating, "One cannot know for sure what Russia felt like in 1917 as the Tsar was being toppled, or France in 1871 in the heady, idealistic days of the short-lived Paris Commune. But it must have felt something like Khartoum in April 2019.
Holy shit.
Right, chills. Yes. And none of these comparisons are overblown. So what has followed these April victories in both countries is months of struggle by the revolutionaries to wrest control from the military regimes, which retain control of the state. In Sudan and Algeria, like in Egypt, the regime's power lies in great part with their militaries. And just like in Egypt in 2011, the militaries felt they had no other choice than to sacrifice the regime's figurehead in order to spare the regime as a whole from basically the wrath of the working class. So while the fall of the two dictators marked the two biggest victories we've seen in the region since 2011, at the same time, they can also be seen as conservative maneuvers by each military, who sought to immediately replace the dictators by another military leader, and in order to make no fundamental change to the state as long as they can get away with it. But this time, the Sudanese and Algerian revolutionaries have learned from the pitfalls of 2011 and from their own previous revolutions, and they refuse to allow this. This is the stalemate that continues today, the struggle between the revolutionaries and the still powerful militaries, who are also unfortunately backed by regional and international imperialist powers. And we can look to the course of events from 2011 to 2013 to predict what turns will be coming and what maneuvers the ruling classes will next attempt, to analyze the mistakes made in Egypt and other Arab Spring countries that the revolutionaries today are cognizant of and working to avoid now, and also to examine what is still needed for a successful revolution that can actually transform the circumstances of the people in the region, some of which we can get from our own tradition. So as with many of the other states in the region, Sudan and Algeria have a triangle of power sharing between the military apparatus, the political institutions, and the capitalist class, who have ruled together for decades using dividing rule tactics, sectarianism, and racism first among them, by suppressing all political freedoms and by crushing the left and co-opting trade unions. The other form of the state in the region is the patrimonial state, as some call it, in which one family, either under a monarchy or a republic, owns the state and the military does its bidding, basically. A good example of this is Syria.
I thought you were going to say Trump.
In the region as a whole, after the death of Arab nationalism and socialism in the late 60s, opposition to the regimes began to take the form of Islamist movements that claimed to offer an alternative, but the vision they put forward was still a reactionary one. These movements of various form were promoted especially by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Iran. And when the 2011 MENA revolutions broke out, the two strongest forces in the region, the regimes and the Islamist movements, became the two dominant poles of counter-revolution, shrinking any space that the progressive activists had taken in the earliest days of the uprisings. Without independent trade unions, revolutionary organizations, or even progressive outlets to discuss and debate tactic and strategy when the movements broke out, the people's revolutionary aspirations had little chance to materialize, and the other two camps were seen as the main warring forces. In order for any successful popular revolution that represents the actual democratic will of the people in the region, there must be a highly organized, progressive, and popular leadership with an understanding of revolutionary history and what it will take to win. But because of historical realities and lessons learned from recent revolutions, this is actually beginning to be possible in Algeria and Sudan today. We're still in the very beginning of a long-term process, which is bound to see defeats and victories along the way. But there are new openings today that we've not seen before, which we should be optimistic about. Part of the reason this opening exists today is because both the regime's militaries and the Islamist organizations are largely discredited in Sudan and Algeria. In Algeria, the National Liberation Front, the FLN, has been the ruling power since 1962 when it ousted the French after 130 years of colonialism. But it soon lost any liberatory or progressive elements that it had, and became an authoritarian enforcer of neoliberalism along with the rest of the regimes of the region. It's been completely discredited along with its so-called National Popular Army, especially because of the fact that the latter killed hundreds of progressive young people in an uprising in 1988, and then in the black decade of civil war in the 90s. Killed tens of thousands in a dirty war against various Islamist groups, most notably the Islamist Salvation Front, who also lost popular support of the Algerian people throughout the course of the war and was defeated and destroyed through the course of the war. Islamist parties today are not in the streets with the protesters. They're notably absent. And Algeria's Muslim Brotherhood has sided decisively with the regime. Given that the demands today are a civil state and contain large feminist contingents challenging the state as well as societal sexism, and there's the rejection of both parties that took part in the dirty war and the shared understanding of the regime and its military as a mafia state, it's fair to say that the vast majority of the population would reject either of the two counter-revolutionary forces today. In Sudan, Omar al-Bashir's regime was both an Islamist regime, allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, and a military dictatorship, turning the popular classes again against both. As scholar Gilbert Ashkar quipped, al-Bashir was a more Sisi, a mix of both of Egypt's counter-revolutionary leaders, their 2012 Muslim Brotherhood President Morsi, who helped entertain the people's faith in the military, and then the current dictator, drawn from the military apparatus itself, who stepped in and reached control, basically, when the Muslim Brotherhood stepped out of line, Sisi. As for al-Bashir, when he installed himself in a coup in 1989, he quickly tried to both militarize and Islamize the state. He built up the National Intelligence and Security Service alongside a number of other militias and police forces. He implemented gender restrictions that have only now begun to be undone with the revolution, and attempted to conservatize the country in a way that alienated not just the Christian South, which ended up seceding because of it, but also the Sufi-leaning North, and really the majority of Sudanese Muslim and non-Muslim. While his regime, like Algeria's, plundered the country's wealth and made deals with the IMF that impoverished much of Sudan, he also waged war against the revolting population of Darfur, massacring up to 500,000 people over the course of a decade, for which he's been wanted for war crimes. But while all this has pushed the Sudanese popular classes to turn against the regime without hesitation, the regime's positioning itself as an Islamist and a military regime gained it the support and protection of the majority of the regional powers, those regimes who are both pro and anti-Muslim Brotherhood, with today Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt are at the forefront of that today. So as we've seen over the last 6 years, the regimes of the region are determined to crush any progressive movement that emerges to challenge their rule, and most often will support each other in doing so, even if they have major disagreements. To crush the first wave of the Arab Spring, the regimes doubled down on sectarianism, murdered and imprisoned tens of thousands of activists, besieged and bombed, and collaborated with regional and international imperialist forces that could ensure their survival against what began as massively popular uprisings. The same threat of repression exists in Algeria and Sudan today and should be taken very seriously, with the regional powers viewing the revolution in Sudan particularly as especially dangerous, given the uprising strength and organization, and also the country's importance in upholding imperialist projects more broadly. By that, I mean Sudan is an asset to Saudi Arabia in its war on Yemen, with about 10,000 Sudanese ground troops taking part in the disastrous war there. An uprising in Sudan with any progressive outcome would be also disastrous for its northern neighbor, Egypt, which, as I mentioned, is under the suffocating control of Sisi and his military. And Sudan is also important for international imperialism, specifically for the EU, which has sent its militias, namely the Rapid Support Forces, created by al-Bashir's war in Darfur. It's sent them billions of dollars since 2014 to police, detain, and deport migrants coming through Sudan in what's called the Khartoum process. And we can talk more about that later. It should be no surprise then that these uprisings have faced repression and likely face even more to come. In Algeria, the protesters have been met with mass arrests and beatings and tear gas. In Sudan, whose revolution has gone much farther at this point, weeks of stalemated negotiations between the military and the Forces for Freedom and Change, followed by a successful strike led by the SPA, pushed the military, with its Egyptian, Saudi, and Emirati backers egging it on, to respond. On the morning of June 3rd, the Rapid Support Forces cracked down with a raid of the Khartoum sit-in, burning the occupation to the ground and massacring over 100 of the revolutionaries throughout the city. And June 3rd, I mean just a month ago. The military completed the lockdown with an internet shutdown, and for nearly a month, the revolution went underground with a shift to mostly nighttime protests and a shift in focus to the neighborhood revolutionary committees instead of the all-out million-person protests and the national strategic actions. So with the military and police enabling the paramilitary force of the RSF, this should have exposed the role of the army, the police, the militias as counter-revolutionary forces, all tied to the old regime. After all, the head of the Rapid Support Forces, which, as I mentioned, grew out of the regime's genocide in Darfur, is General Mohamed Hemedti Diallo, who's also second in command of the Transitional Military Council, which is really just the old military. And, using the name transitional to sound like something. And he's perhaps the most powerful person in Sudan today, Hemedti. So there should be no illusions in the military and its desire to crush the popular revolution. And the risk they still pose needs to be analyzed, thought about carefully. Fortunately, even under internet shutdown, the SPA managed to organize another million-person march. It was just this past weekend on June 30th, and it filled the streets of Sudan and managed to basically revive the spirit of the revolution after, for the first time since the June 3rd massacre. So the opening we see today in Algeria and Sudan is, I would argue, in largest part due to the lessons learned from the first phase of the Arab Spring and from Algeria and Sudan's previous uprisings. How to protect and sustain your revolution, what were the fatal mistakes in Egypt and elsewhere, and some of the most fundamental learnings from 2011 have changed the landscape of possibilities today for the better. There are still gaps and lessons that can be learned from our tradition, which I'll try to touch on. First among these lessons is to maintain the peaceful character of your revolution. Since the regimes have a monopoly on violence, as well as the backing of regional and international imperialist powers. Ultimately, the level of violence is decided on by the regimes, but strategic use of tactics on the part of the uprising can prove more successful and avoid spiraling into more violence. This also includes firm rejection of the regime's racism, sectarianism, and sexism, the divide and conquer tactics which the regimes deploy in full force after against progressive uprisings. Both Algeria and Sudan have worked to maintain the peaceful aspects of their uprisings, with activists in Sudan erecting checkpoints, I think I mentioned, at their sit-ins to prevent weapons from entering. There's an understanding that taking up arms can be the regime's excuse for a full-scale scorched earth policy to destroy the revolution as occurred in Syria. And in both countries, the revolutionaries have seen the role of international forces intervening in the region and reject foreign intervention and aid. So when Egypt and Saudi and the UAE pledged, what, $3 billion to the Transitional Military Council, the people said, we don't want any of your aid. Immediately, that was the immediate response. Algeria's history of colonialism, too, plays a part in this kind of knee-jerk distrust in foreign intervention, which is, again, an asset to the uprisings. And it's different because in the first round of the Arab Spring, there were movements that did call for outside intervention at times. And there's an understanding of regional dynamics with solidarity with the Palestinian and Syrian struggles viewed as central. Coupled with an outright rejection of sectarianism and racism, there seems to be little room for the regime to intervene ideologically. In Algeria in particular, the younger generation has embraced its Amazigh culture against both the regime and Islamist parties who've tried to Arabize and repress indigenous Berber culture. Amazigh and Palestinian flags can be seen as often as the Algerian flag in the uprising. In the past few weeks, the regime has banned the Amazigh flag outright, and even there have been videos of them attacking and trying to remove Palestinian flags from protesters, which is probably just going to shoot themselves in the foot, considering it's considered fundamental to be in solidarity with Palestine, and even the state claims to be. In Sudan, the chant, "We are all Darfur," began in the early days of the uprising, with anti-racism also viewed as central to opposing al-Bashir's regime. It has been pointed out, though, that many were shocked at the level of brutality at the rapid support forces in Khartoum in June, having basically hardly fathomed the extent of the brutality that was regularly perpetrated in Darfur. And as for rejecting sexism, the role of women in both movements has been enormous. Up to 80% of demonstrators in many of Sudan's protests in the sit-in have been women. With women like 23-year-old Ala Saleh, I'm sure many of you have seen her image in white. She led chants that were basically recalling the revolutionary position of women in Sudan's history. And in Algeria, feminist contingents mobilized each week and organized a massive presence on International Women's Day, calling for an end to Algeria's family code and challenging societal sexism as it unfortunately has emerged within the protests. The second major lesson, marking the largest shift forward from 2011, is the revolutionary movement's understanding and agreement that the removal of the figurehead of the regime is not enough and cannot bring about a successful revolution on its own. In Egypt, after the people overthrew Hosni Mubarak and the SCAF asserted that it had the people's best interests at heart and could manage the country in its transition, the revolutionaries left the street and went back home. They left Tahrir and they put their trust in the military without understanding that this military represented the exact same regime. This same scenario repeated itself multiple times in Egypt, actually, worst of all in the coup of 2013, leading to Sisi's iron-fisted dictatorship today. But in Sudan, when Ibn Auf, the immediate replacement of al-Bashir for a total of 30 hours, the men and women at Khartoum sit-in did not celebrate. They said, in interviews at the sit-in, the demonstrators said, "They replaced one criminal with another. It's the same regime still. We won't leave this spot until it all falls," and so on. And the sit-ins continued with a demand for a civil state and no military transition or control. So two incredible chants actually went up on Sudan's walls, either civil government or permanent revolution, and either victory or Egypt. I mean, a little dismal at the same time. In Algeria, too, the regime has attempted to pacify the movement by first removing Bouteflika, then several of the country's wealthiest capitalists and corrupt cronies at the top. Still, General Gaid Salah, Bouteflika's ally within the military since 2004, is basically running the show behind the scenes. tactically switching from forcing Bouteflika out and claiming to be on the side of the movement, as they all do, to demanding protesters adhere to the constitution and ready themselves for elections. But they haven't succeeded in quieting the movement, and the millions say that it will not be enough until it all falls. However, in Algeria, the distrust in the regime and all corrupt parties has led to a distrust in leadership more generally. In reaction to the corruption and collusion of not just the regime, but Islamist parties, and unfortunately the left and its workers' party as well, the movement is relatively leaderless and horizontal, similar again to Egypt and many of the revolutions of 2011. This is the first major distinction between Algeria and Sudan, putting Sudan basically far ahead and exposing the movement in Algeria to more danger and weaknesses. Another reason for this horizontal formation is the UGTA, the major trade union in Algeria, has been subordinated to the regime, and its bureaucratic leadership co-opted. A struggle has emerged recently within the union, with the rank and file attempting to take back control, which is a source of optimism and hope, along with the ongoing strike waves. But in Sudan, the forces of freedom and change, and the Sudanese Professional Association in particular, marks an enormous step forward in terms of organization. The SPA calls strikes and decides strategy, provides necessary leadership and direction for the revolution nationally. And making it have the potential to actually take state power. We've seen them call the million person marches, coordinate strikes and marches by different industries, and as well as general strikes that basically terrify the regime and its backers. But there are still limitations here too. The forces for freedom and change include the traditional opposition, whom the military has been attempting to win over, and others pushing for negotiation and concessions with the military. And the SPA, crucially, does not represent the entire working class. It is made up of professionals and some sectors who have been pushed into the working class due to the last 30 years of neoliberalism. But their interests are more moderate than radical in many respects. And since they do not actually represent the working class, they're also not engaging in fully democratic decision-making that could further the revolution. In addition, since the forces for freedom and change could be said to represent the interests of the middle class, what change would they bring about on an economic level? And would it even attempt to satisfy the needs of the working classes who have been so immiserated by neoliberalism, which was the primary factor that brought them out to protest in the first place? As we've seen in places like Tunisia, there can be no resolution without a change in economic realities that at the very least addresses massive unemployment, makes bread and other basic necessities affordable again, and gives workers control over their own circumstances. And still, the fundamental question exists: what will it take to fully overthrow the regime? One lesson from our tradition, as well as from Egypt and the 2011 revolutions, is that we can't take a revolution halfway. That will only lead to its repression and to its brutal destruction. Currently in Sudan and Algeria, there's the question of democratic and fair elections, timelines, and how to ensure they're free. So General Gaid Salah in Algeria pushed for elections for July 4th, actually, but the movement resisted. No serious candidates came forward, especially none that could represent anything other than the old regime, and they were forced to cancel them. The regime then tried pushing for a civil society forum to put dialogue with the regime on the agenda, with like NGOs and other types who don't represent the working class. And a loose coalition of left organizations have rejected this plan and all dialogue with the regime. However, in Sudan, many of you may have heard, last night negotiations actually were finalized. Or there was an agreement made last night with the military council, which I believe is a bad omen for the success of the revolution. On the one hand, it makes sense to postpone elections for 3 years, which is agreed upon, to enable the new opposition to create a foundation for itself, rather than the alternative being handing over elections to the regime if it's too soon in both countries. The decision last night was to create a joint transitional council, which is, I believe, a very dangerous concession. As Anne Alexander writes in her analysis of the revolutions, our tradition makes clear the need to get rid of bodies of armed men, the military and the RSF as well in this case. Otherwise, they will reverse all successes and reforms won by the revolutionary movement and exchange it for an even more repressive dictatorship. Again, Sisi is the best example of this. So after the June 3rd massacre in Sudan, the military council should have been completely rejected with the demand for, you know, zero members of the military council in the transitional government rather than five or seven that was agreed upon. As well as the demand that it be disbanded and its leaders, including Hamedi, be jailed until trial for war crimes, for their crimes in June and their crimes against Darfur. This could still be accomplished through strikes that are outside the jurisdiction, most likely of the SPA or the Forces for Freedom and Change, who have shown that they're too willing to come to concessions. Decision making must come from different sectors of the working class through the neighborhood committees that now exist and also workers' committees that can be more representative than the SPA. There are many more lessons that can be taken away from the first round of the Arab Spring revolutions that now lean into Sudan and Algeria and from the Marxist tradition, and I hope we can discuss them more together. There are also important lessons for the international left. First among them, the need for a clear analysis and solidarity with the working class and the popular classes against all regional and international regimes. There can't be cookie cutter analysis and cut and paste responses. We've seen this a lot lately, I would say, with Syria and then Venezuela. I know that's not in the region, but it's obvious now that you can't just have the same solution everywhere. There must be a clear analysis of where the working class is positioned, of the counter-revolutionary forces, and of how to provide solidarity. This leads to another lesson from our past weaknesses. The left in the MENA region and internationally regularly sided with one of the two counter-revolutionary forces after 2011, either choosing the side of the regimes or the Muslim Brotherhood, with the best example, again, being Egypt and flip-flopping of the left in regards to Morsi and the coup, instead of a clear-eyed understanding that neither force should be supported, and an alternative must be. Today in Algeria, actually, the Left Workers' Party is held back for its long support of Bouteflika. Its leader, Louise Hanoun, is actually in jail, but she's for years she defended the regime, except for its excesses, basically. We should learn instead from the Sudanese and Algerian people who oppose the options put out in front of them, put solidarity with Palestinians and Syrians first, and have not fallen into these traps that much of the left has fallen into. There's so much more to discuss, and I hope we can do that in the discussion. Thank you.